We learn best with a guide by our side, not that sage on the stage. The person that is willing to support you and help you, but also to provoke you to ask questions. In the United States right now, not quite a third, but pretty close to that number of students are dropping out of high school. The number one reason for their why they're dropping out is boredom. You know, there's 3.8 billion years of time that has led to this point where we are who we are, and we can experience the world the way we experience it because we have been a part of it and we've learned from it the whole time.
Hello, and welcome to the Earthy Chats podcast, where we're cross-pollinating environmental education ideas. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Harvey-Berrill.
And I'm your other host, Ian Shanahan.
Let's get started.
Now, there are other reasons to do this too, you know, and that another key thing for schools besides academic and educational learning is safety and well-being, right? It's a school's responsibility to provide a safe place, and not just physically safe, but emotionally safe, socially safe, mentally safe. And being outdoors and being in nature provides a higher level of safety for students. It gives kids.
So welcome to this edition of Earthy Chats. We're cross-pollinating environmental education ideas. Joining us today is the fantastic David Den Hartog of the Green Schools National Network. So David's been a classroom teacher, principal, school coach, and educational entrepreneur. Can't wait to hear about that. Teaching, traveling, and learning throughout the United States and in many countries around the world. Fostering deep learning has been at the core of David's work, both with his own students and in the role of educational coach. Recognizing that collective self-efficacy is the most powerful driver of student success, David strives to help build mindsets that embrace excellence while strengthening relationships. Welcome, David.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the nice introduction. I think those kind words are things I strive for. I don't know what percent of the time those are actually true, but I'm glad to be here with you all and explore some fun topics together. Thank you for the work that you all do.
It's so exciting to meet new people who education can mean many things, and to be an educator, one of our sort of things we like to say here at the Outdoor Learning Store is that and everybody's an educator in one way, but you've been an award-winning classroom teacher, a principal, a founding director of a new school. You've worked for different education academies in coaching and leadership. So How did you get into those roles? How did you become an educator, and where did you come from?
Well, I also have that same perspective that you do, that everybody's an educator. And oftentimes people will say, like, well, you do that because you're an educator, or I'm not an educator. And truly, any position, any person's job, in some ways we're teaching. And oftentimes what's not happening is that we're not super intentional or even aware of what we are teaching. And for me, I didn't necessarily initially pursue the formal role of being an educator. My degree was in political science and in management, undergrad degree, and went to grad school thinking that I would be a professor in political science or finish and get my law degree. And honestly, after traveling, I spent a year going around the world for a year after I graduated college, and then I went to grad school for a year, and then I took another year off and traveled for another year throughout the world. And during both of those experiences, it's kind of like that enlightening opportunity where it's like, okay, what I really need and want to do is work with young people, and middle school and high school kids were what was drawing me. So I shifted my direction, and it led me into education and to work with those grade levels of students. But also during that time, I also recognized and knew that the education system in many ways is not healthy, and oftentimes it's described as broken. And I would say for the most part, how I describe it is just relishing in mediocrity. And sadly, we're so accepting of that, that it hasn't changed a lot. And as a matter of fact, continues to just need people that are dedicated and advocates of excellence. And although it's difficult and not easy, that's what has gotten me the most excited. It's like, how can I be involved in the education system to help really give students what they deserve and help them provide opportunities that provide pathways to be successful and excited and interested and curious, all those things that we would hope for any child when they're in a school system. So that's the path I've been on, and it's provided a lot of different streets to go down to get to this place. But I am grateful for all those opportunities and excited for where it's led me to today.
That's so fantastic. And I really like the fact that when you mention excellence, that you also then talked about sort of what they deserve as young people, and that excellence might not just be academic. It's a well-being. It's having capacity to build relationships, having social capital to move forward. So that's a really powerful shift in mentality that I think. And I too traveled the world and ditched science to go into schools in Arctic Norway and France and Australia and New Zealand, and now here to see how different school systems work. And the things that I found most successful are these more integrated environments that look at multiple aspects of what it means to be successful, as opposed to just perhaps the British way, like I grew up, which is academic excellence. And then followed by maybe physical excellence in sport. Like, these are the priorities. And so I'm really powerful. It's empowering to see people in leadership positions more and more that see the other benefits of different aspects. You're now the Director of Innovative Learning for the Green Schools National Network. Can you explain who they are?
Yes, of course. Well, first of all, I would say that my role has shifted slightly. I'm now like a key strategy coach, and that's my title. But I love the Director of Innovative Learning title. And I mostly like to create titles for myself that are fun acronyms. And so that one I created because it's one of my favorite characters in To Kill a Mockingbird. Dill is one of my favorite characters. So, yeah. You know, I always thought that'd be a good one to have at some point. So I've had that a couple different times in jobs. But now, working with Green Schools, I get to help lead our work within our schools and districts that are trying to think about equity, health, and sustainability in a very comprehensive way and be more strategic and systematic about integrating that on a more consistent basis. And so I travel mostly the U.S. to get to schools and districts to help them to do that transformational work. And most of my work involves helping people go further, farther, and faster with things that they've started or want to go and do more of. And so it's very different everywhere I go. Last week, I was in both New Mexico, working with two different schools and school districts, and also in Northern Illinois. That's where I was on Monday, working with a school that has an environmental education focus. So it's very diverse and fun, and I get to work with all kinds of folks to do this work. So I feel super grateful for that.
And what's the outcome that you're trying to achieve with this having a Green Schools National Network, and something that I think potentially in Canada is relevant as well, in networking sort of really being a system in place that can support the success of everybody within it?
Yeah. So for, you know, there are a variety of different organizations doing work in this field of green education or environmental ed. And for us at Green Schools National Network, it's what we try to focus on is this holistic look at what actually makes all the components of a school. So for us, it's been using what we call the Green Print, which is this outline and document that helps frame what those things look like. So we have 20 different core practices within the Green Print that are aligned to four impact systems, which include leadership, curriculum instruction, culture and climate, and facilities and operations. So we know that schools in general are focused in all four of those areas. How can we help them strategize to really not only embrace a mindset connected to sustainability, but truly integrate that and make that a lens in which everybody thinks about and uses while they go about their daily business of running a school? And for the most part, and I credit Jamie Cloud at the Cloud Institute for saying this initially, and I adopted it, is for the most part, we're really good in education at unsustainable education. And so how do we shift to sustainable education or sustainability education? And we're not doing a ton of that well yet. And we have aspirations, and there are some folks doing it better than others. But for the most part, that's not what's predominantly happening in schools. So that's our work. And that's my now life work, is to help try to transform schools to bring that at a higher degree into the framework of everything that they do.
It's really powerful stuff. I really like the idea of that holistic approach where, multiple views are seen. And from what you're saying to me, I think in my experience being in school boards and districts here and in lots of other places as well, but is that, you know, you might have a few very passionate educators doing this work sort of independently, making the effort, let's say, to take their learning outside or integrate sustainability and climate education into literacy or numeracy. And then you may have very supportive administrators, leadership in some places who are just like, yes, or you might not have administrators who are comfortable with this. And so it seems to me like with those core practices that it can transcend the boundaries, both of you know, the sort of top-down, bottom-up relationships of people facilitating education, and also of, you know, different provincial or state mandates or specificities within the educational curriculum. Because if you just develop these core practices that are relevant to all, then people can engage with them.
I think you're exactly right and on track. That's our goal, is to kind of help focus both on the leaders and the people who are initiating these efforts, because in many ways they control the destiny and the pathway that people follow and the expectations, but yet it's
and the funding people,
and the funding, right? But it's the people on the ground, the teachers, that are really leading this effort, and they need to be bought in and have the resources and the support that they need in order to be successful. So they need that help and direction as well. So it's both. So you're right. We try to support on both ends of that spectrum. And just to give you a quick example to what you just said, I travel to a lot of schools where I see orphaned gardens, I call them, where there was a passionate person that started doing gardens with their classroom or the school. But that person left, or that parent left, or somebody left, that's no longer there, and it's just sitting idle and decrepit, and sometimes is not only an eyesore, but sometimes, you know, it's a provocation for leaders to look at and say, see, if we're going to give you a garden, look what happens. And they just, you know, oh, it's a waste. It's a waste of energy and time and money. So when people come to us and say, we would love to have a garden in our school, you know, our typical response is, we really don't recommend it unless it's fully integrated within the curriculum of the school. And unless it's part of the system that is going to be there no matter who is there, then it might not be a good idea to really put something extra in that is only going to live for a year or two. Because in the end, 10 years from now, it might actually detract others from being successful in doing that and integrating that. So that's part of what we try to do, is help people shift their systems so that it supports things like gardens and outdoor learning on a more consistent, long-term basis in that environment.
But it seems you're providing this sort of base of support so that the infrastructure is there for it to be successful. And I feel like as we see these sort of shifts in legislation or perhaps direction that I'm gratefully seeing relates to outdoor learning, relates to sustainability and climate learning being embedded in education systems, but that you can't just say, okay, I'm going to do that. I have no prior knowledge. You know, it takes a lot of work to shift and embed these educational cultures. So it's fantastic that you're doing that. I mean, for us, one of the big things about, we've got a few different sort of stages to this learning in sort of a green school. But one of them is learning in nature itself. And I wonder if you can share some of the common barriers to outdoor learning that you've seen in schools or districts that you work with through the Green Schools National Network.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like we want and we recognize, and certainly, you know, the three of us are on the same page and advocates for the environment and recognize the issues, the big issues that are in front of us, and feel the pressure to move faster. And many people feel that, but they haven't necessarily figured out what to do, how to do, what to do next, how to do that, or even sometimes feel as compelled as we would want them to feel. And I'm talking about mostly educators and teachers and teacher leaders and administrators. And frankly, I think one of the biggest hurdles for folks is that they haven't developed their own relationship with the natural world. They've walked outside and they drive their car, but they haven't spent extensive time sleeping on the ground or planting a garden or really, you know, connecting in a significant way to the outdoors. And that's partly because it's so easy not to do that. We've made it extremely easy as humans now to avoid spending time outdoors. And schools are a prime example of that, is that many, many, many schools are built to mostly keep kids indoors. And, you know, we hear more pledges now than ever to build schools almost like fortresses to, you know, keep the bad people out. But in some ways, what it is keeping the good people in, you know, like it's almost with intentionality to not get kids and the adults outdoors. So we have to push back on that. And there are some people doing that, and great architects and engineers and a wide variety of people that are pushing back on that and saying that's not healthy for us as humans, as young people, as students, as learners, to spend that amount of time indoors. And so, you know, part of our push is just to think about how can you do any lesson, anything that you are going to teach outside, and doing that one thing, whatever it might be, teaching literacy or doing your math lesson or whatever it might be, and just go outside and just do that. There are multiple benefits. And so just starting that step initially for people is a big step. In some cases, because many educators are not used to that. Many schools are not set up or designed to help facilitate that. And not just on the physical side, they're not set up with time and space or the right doorways or access. You know, there's a lot of barriers that are in place that prevent people from, you know, not necessarily even wanting to go outside, but even going outside. So how do we, you know, there's a lot of things to affect and impact, but if we just try to shift the mindset of like, we're going to just do more outdoor learning, we're going to be in nature more significantly. What ends up happening is that we develop a relationship, right? And we, as everybody knows, that you don't love something that you don't have a relationship with. So if we want people to be advocates and we want them to be stewards and you know, people that are going to be there and connected to the natural world, it means having a relationship. And so just sitting outdoors is one of those things that's going to lead to that. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And it's funny because when we talk about, humanity, if you look, I mean, you only have to go back a few hundred years, and we were learning in nature. We spent all of our time in nature. If you go back to ancient civilizations and more recently indigenous civilizations here, we're in relationship with the land at all times. Even when there were buildings, they were open in order to still be connected to that natural world. And that's it's a very powerful thing that you're doing to remind people of that.
Thank you. I want to give you another quick example that's disturbing, but it's has some hope in it as well. I get to work with an indigenous group of folks in New Mexico. And a couple of different groups, actually. And they're amazing. They've taught me so much. I feel extremely blessed to be able to spend time with them. But in their school, that's a traditional district school that's part of the state system, they have been told how poor performing they are and how their kids are not doing well in literacy and math, especially. And they need to spend more time drilling and teaching literacy and math. And so what it's now led to is those elementary students are getting 15 minutes of recess. So out of the entire day,
Oof.
that's the total amount of time that kids are getting outdoors on a regular basis, 15 minutes. And it's just crazy because what is end up happening is because of the emphasis on wanting kids to be better on literacy and math, and because they've been forced to, and I don't necessarily blame the administrators because the state is the one who's pushing them to be this way as well. And it's this false dichotomy of accountability that's perverse in what we're really recognizing as what good education is. But it's just an example of what is happening out there in a traditional community that, has millennia of years. This group of people have lived in this one community for over 5,000 years. They have been there that long, at least probably longer than that. And now the school system is in some ways preventing the kids from having that connection because of a false sense of what is important. And it's disturbing, but it's part of why, like I'm part of the process to get them to try to think differently about what they're doing. And I think that there's hope there because there's people that are recognizing like, oh, we need to think about this a little bit differently. But it's just one example that's happening all over, not only the US, but in many, many countries and places around the world, is that false kind of perspective about what qualifies as healthy, excellent education. And so I'm doing my best. Our organization's doing our best. You folks are as well, I know, helping to change that.
All of the resources featured in this podcast, plus many more, for students and educators alike, can be found online at the Outdoor Learning Store. Visit www.outdoorlearningstore.ca to view what's on offer. From waterproof notepads to binoculars and dip nets to sit pads, the store has you covered to take your learning outside. In addition, there are educator resource books to help you take your outdoor education to the highest level. That's www.outdoorlearningstore.ca. We're Canada's non-profit resource store.
And that pivots really nicely to this discussion about learning about nature, because that just doesn't seem to be prioritized in that many education systems, certainly not state, provincial, national education systems. Whereas, depending on where you look, it has been valued more. And I always like to come back to this example of Anne of Green Gables, a place, well, not a real place, but Prince Edward Island, a place I've been to several times, and Anne of Green Gables is prominent despite the fact that it's a fictional story. But one of her teachers, Miss Stacy, I don't know how familiar you are with the story, but she really gets Anne on a good track because she takes the class outside learning in nature, but also learning about nature. What I think is unique about this character of Miss Stacy is that she knows her facts. And this, when we talk about barriers, is something that I certainly hear a lot from educators as well. I'd love to teach more about nature, but I don't know all the plants. I don't know all the insects and bird songs and so on. Do you hear that sort of comment a fair bit?
Yeah, that's such a good point, Ian, that it emerges all the time.
Yeah.
And as we as educators have been instructed or kind of sold on this idea that we're supposed to be the sage on the stage,
right? Course.
Like we're supposed to be the one with the knowledge, imparting it on these either young people or people in front of us, you know, like this. And it's this another one of those false dichotomies of power that gets embedded within what people perceive as good education. And probably the three of us would recognize, like, we learn best with a guide by our side, not that sage on the stage, right? Like, so the person that is willing to support you and help you, but also to provoke you to ask questions and to think more deeply about what's around you. So when teachers say that, because they often say what you just said, Ian, is like, I don't know, I'm not good at that. I haven't studied that. I'm not a environmental ed person. I don't know all the plants and the trees and the bugs. And it's not necessarily about knowing all those things. It's just getting kids outside to ask some questions and they'll figure it out, right? Like we are in a time and an age where the knowledge is at our fingertips, but the interest in wanting to get the knowledge is not at your fingertips, right? Like that has to be experienced. And so that's what we're really trying to facilitate, is that it's not that you can name the trees or even all the insects or the plants that are around you, but what is it, what do you want to learn about? Like, why would you want to learn about them, those things? What questions do you have about that beetle? Why did it even get the name beetle? Like, where'd that word come from? Do people call it different things? You know? And so there's this whole exploration, not just of science, but of language and of literacy and of history that all emerge just by getting outside and being curious. And that doesn't require on an educator's part as the adult facilitating a high level of knowledge about nature, except that there are a lot of things out there and there are a lot of things to explore. And it's a lot of fun to explore this. And, you know, the amazing thing is kids can be and are our experts. And along with, there are just so many other people and resources that are close by that we often don't tap into as well. And especially in our own communities, that people with this knowledge. So you as a teacher don't need to have that knowledge. You don't need to know all the trees. You don't need to know all the insects. You don't even know have to know that much about any of the little beetles. You just need to help kids to be able to see them and think about what is it they want to know about them? Like, what do we want to learn? And help them to foster that curiosity. So that's where I often go, Ian. But that's a good point that you bring up. Thank you.
And do you ever get people saying, you know, this is great, but why? Why is it important to learn about the beetles and what eats the beetles and, you know, what bird nests are used for afterwards? And just looking at all of these ecological relationships, do you ever get that why question? Like, why is this important?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And that's why, like, I think up front, it's important for organizations like us, Green Schools, when we start working with the school district, it's some people will say, well, that just sounds like just fun. You're just going and playing and you're having fun. Like, I'm all for that. So like,
guilty as charged.
Say, yeah, let's just do it. Let's just have fun. Why not? Let's just have fun. But they also are like, well, we've got our standards and we've got to get through these things. And this is what you need to cover. And it's about content. And that's one of those another perverse things that have led to the mediocrity in education, is this false sense of needing to cover things and the content and the number of standards. The United States, our textbooks are bigger than any other country in the world. Like, we have put so much stuff that we've now told teachers that they're supposed to teach that it doesn't even allow for exploration. But to come back to your point, I think that just giving people that opportunity to, and young people especially, but also the adults, to be open to like this is connected to those core things that we do in education. If we think about educational success, so much of it comes back to engagement and interest. In the United States right now, not quite a third, but pretty close to that number of students are dropping out of high school. The number one reason for their why they're dropping out is boredom. Is they're just not interested. They don't feel like it's connected. They don't think it's relevant. They're not dropping out because they're drugs or addictions or whatever it might be, or other things, or they're not being successful or whatever it might be. It's just because they're bored. So if engagement is one of those key things that we want, it helps to answer the why. Like we're doing this because we want our kids to be really engaged and excited about learning, right? Now there are other reasons to do this too, and that another key thing for schools besides academic and educational learning is safety and well-being, right? It's a school's responsibility to provide a safe place, and not just physically safe, but emotionally safe, socially safe, mentally safe. And being outdoors and being in nature provides a higher level of safety for students. It gives kids healthiness that they wouldn't get if they stayed inside all the time. So if you want another why, here's a second why. And then there's this third component of schools, which is about finance and viability. And if we want to be conservers of money for our schools, or be well good stewards of the resources that we have, we will be, concerned about the amount of money that we're spending on energy and water and our waste, right? Those are all expenses that we have as schools that are constants, that are there for every school. And if we're more consistent on recognizing and more interested and passionate about wanting to limit our amount of energy use, it's cool on a limiting our carbon footprint, of course, but it's also going to save us money as
Yep, who
well.
doesn't want to do that?
And yeah, exactly. And put more money in for teachers, for programs, for whatever it might be. So if you think through the lens of those three things, educational academics, safety and health and well-being, along with financial viability, those are your answers to your why. Like, to me, there's absolutely no opposite argument for this. Like, you would be, if everybody knew these things and understood them, everybody would be incorporating at this a high level. So, but you can tell I'm kind of passionate
For
about
sure. And I mean,
it.
we're part of the proverbial choir, but those are
Yeah.
totally salient points that I think give on-ramps for people from many different perspectives. And that's really what's critical about any social movement, if you want to call it that, is making sure that it's just easy and natural for people to get on board. And you've laid that out really well.
Thank you.
We are the Columbia Basin Environmental Education Network, or CBEEN. You can visit our website at cbeen.ca. We are the regional network for environmental education in the Columbia Basin, supporting a community of engaged and effective environmental educators by connecting them to resources, information, professional development, and networking opportunities. So we've been learning in nature, we've been learning about nature, and now it's about that movement into learning from nature. And so in our circles, I feel like perhaps we're utilizing this language a lot. But for me, it wasn't in the language of science, really, that I studied in, that I held as my sort of very strong, commonly held beliefs were really around what information can I extract? But I didn't see it in a wider sense of what does that then share with me beyond, let's say, extracting paleoclimatic data from fossils, which was my thing. What can you tell me about the previous ecological history 400,000 years ago when you were pulling oxygen and other gases from the sky to make your shell, for example. And now my relationship with learning from nature has shifted, basically directly as a result of connecting to Indigenous perspectives and learning from people who have had a different and more integrated relationship with the land. And I use that with a capital L as a, not just as a thing separate from me, but within me. And so I wonder what your thoughts are on some of the most significant lessons we can learn from nature, and what does that mean?
Yeah, thanks for framing it that way, Jade. One of the things I think about a lot is language, and I love linguists. I wish I, that's probably another life of mine, is like, we'll come back a future as a linguist, because I am fascinated with that. Because even the word nature implies it's something different than humans. And so, you know, we talk about humans and humans being out in nature, not necessarily as humans as nature, right? And that is, I think, something important for us to be, continue to be cognizant of, is that even in our language, we're separating ourselves from the natural world instead of embracing the fact that we are all as an ecological system together and part of this whole, right? And so when we think through that lens, which in many ways, like you said, is this Indigenous ways of knowing, and it's embedded in us, and it is an intuitive, but we've kind of pushed it out of ourselves to some degree. And so it's bringing this back for ourselves and being more closely into what truly is what makes us human, is that learning from, you know, that's how we've gotten here as being a human. You know, there's 3.8 billion years of time that has led to this point where we are who we are, and we can experience the world the way we experience it because we have been a part of it and we've learned from it the whole time. And so if we continue to think through that, we'll recognize all the variety of lessons that everything around us is teaching us. And I love that. I love thinking through that framework, because it's not only like the functions of nature and how is a tree moving water all the way up against gravity, you know, through its trunk without a pump system? Like what is going on? Like, how is that even working? You know, like it's amazing to think that can happen. And somehow, and I don't know, you know, there's, I love thinking about trees. Trees are one of my favorite things to be thinking about. So, and, with the author who wrote Hidden Life of Trees, and he's, he's written another, Heartbeat of Trees. What, you and I are talking about that, Ian?
Heartbeat of Trees? Yeah, I mean, he's written many books. I mean, you see it on the bookshelf now. It's just, so much.
Yeah. But in that Heartbeat of Trees, it talks about like trees actually constrict just a tiny bit at night and then go back. So it's almost like squeezing toothpaste, you know, like they're moving water just by that tiny bit of movement, which is really amazing. Like, how's that actually happening? So thinking about what nature can teach us and what we can learn from it leads to how we can design things that will be better at mimicking that. But it's not just the physical things, it's the social things too. You know, for example, we know that really rich soil is highly diverse, has a lot of microbes and all kinds of materials and minerals and a variety of things inside there, right? So how does rich soil also connect to a kindergarten classroom, right? Like, what could a kindergarten or a first grade classroom learn from, you know, soil that is super healthy to soil that's not so healthy? You know, like, what does that mean for us as a classroom to embrace the diversity of everybody's opinions or of people in general? And where can we be more rich as a group of, you know, second graders, and mimic what is happening in really rich soil. And that particular lesson, just to share that, Green Schools National Network worked with the Biomimicry Institute to create a series of 10 lessons that that is the second grade lesson. Actually, it's on soil and using that example. But there's all kinds of things like that that we can be learning from. And I just love thinking through that lens too, which is, you know, we've talked about in and about and from provides another direction, another way to make that connection. And it all comes back to us feeling like there's a lot to learn, like we have a lot to gain from being open to all those lessons that are out there around us.
It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
What you're saying, I'm like, yes, I love soil. Soil is my favorite stuff to do. And our detritivores are the unsung heroes. And I love telling kids, you know, there'd be like a kilometer of just sludge waste for us to wade through if we didn't have the detritivores and the icky, crawly, creepy things breaking down the waste of the natural world. Yeah. So I'm with you. And biomimicry, I have little biomimicry cards. Wow. Where this is a big literacy thing we do, and the kids teach each other in this sort of circle where they all speak from each other and they get a card. And you can do the research project yourself. But for example, why professional swimsuits are mimics shark skin, and why climbing shoes are based around the shape and grip protection that goats have, mountain goats and things like that. And it just, you just watch the cogs turning. And if we need the next generation of out of the box thinkers, problem solvers, creators, to give them inspiration, but that it's all around you, it's just magic.
I love that. And you're going to have to share that with me. I want to see more of those. We'll have some things to share with each other, I think.
They're super. And they first have to find them. They're little laminated cards with a picture and a description. And they find one they're interested in. And then as a group. Anyway, we're running out of time, but let's collect more. It's one of my favorite things is biomimicry. Yeah. And to plug another podcast, there's a BBC podcast called 50 Animals That Made Us Smarter. They're 15-minute shorts, all based around biomimicry. Mm-hmm. And they are a great start to your day. Yeah. Obviously, they're free, they're child friendly. That is a really nice way for, if you don't have the knowledge or you haven't got the time to prep these cards yet, just to listen to that and then spark a discussion with your class as your morning ritual.
That sounds amazing. What a great recommendation. Thank you for that.
Stoked on Science, providing engaging, educational and fun programs across the Columbia Basin. Is your school or organisation looking to develop your environmental programming, connect your outdoor time more deeply to the curriculum, or engage your students or teachers with unique programmes that go beyond the basic science topics, like delving into the history of the Earth, how it's changed and where it's going? If so, visit www.stokedonscience.com to connect for environmental education consulting or to book programs for your K-12 and adult professional development courses.
Well, before we wrap it up, we have one more preposition, learning for nature. We've talked a lot about reciprocity in many other episodes of the podcast on a lot of our virtual workshops. And with books like Braiding Sweetgrass, reciprocity is, you could call it maybe a bit of a buzzword, not that it hasn't been for millennia, but in our modern age, we've certainly moved away from reciprocity in many ways and more towards the sort of individualistic society. Mm. You use a really interesting word in your organizational literature when describing learning for nature. You describe learners as being solutionaries. You talked about being a linguist. I may also have been a linguist in a previous life. And I love just everything attached to that word, solutionaries. Mm. How do learners benefit from being solutionaries who are learning for nature?
Yeah, what I love about thinking about learning for nature and just that concept is how do we give back or, you know, give to something else. And when we all know that, like, when we're giving, we're also getting, and oftentimes we get the most when we're giving the most. And there's lots of parables and a variety of things that help to summarize that thought. But learning for nature provides this perspective of, like, that I'm here to help. I'm here to be part of the solution. And we talk a lot about green schools, just this recognition of optimism, hope, action, and solutionaries. And that in our world today, sadly, there's a high level of pessimism, anxiety, stress, high level of especially teenagers that are dealing with some, you know, very significant and understandable challenges that have led to a lack of optimism and hope. And we also know there's all kinds of scientific and literature that recognizes the fact that people are not action oriented if you're pessimistic and you're stressed or you have high anxiety. Like, you will find a place or a rock to go underneath. You will find a hideout. You're not going to be a solutionary unless you have a level of optimism and hope. So yes, we do need to teach about climate and what's going on and where things are. But if the students don't feel like there is hope, that they can be optimistic about their future, we're really doing a disservice. Like, we need to be able to facilitate opportunities where they can feel like they can take action and have agency and feel empowered and make a difference. And every student, we can give every student that opportunity. Like, doesn't matter if they're a kindergartner all the way up through 12th graders. As a matter of fact, it's our job. It's our, I think, one of the primary responsibilities as an educator is to give opportunities for young people to solve problems and to be there and recognize, like, they are an important part of the community. We need them, you know, like, they are vital. It's not just they're there and we're babysitting them, because that's oftentimes what people now look at education, and it emerged in COVID. It's like, we just want our kids away and there. We don't even care if they're learning anything. We need them to be in a space. But if we are going to be and exist as humans in the future, we do really need to think about how we're supporting our young people in a way that leads to more optimism and hope and leads to everybody being more action oriented and solutionaries. And I know we're talking about young people and education, but frankly, it's adults, and it's adults as much and more than anything. I have a 23-year-old, my youngest daughter, gets the most frustrated when she hears, "We're counting on your generation." Because yeah. She's like, "Hey, how about your generation? Are you going to die tomorrow or what's going on? Come on, let's get going.
We're all here."
Yeah, exactly. So I'm very cautious and often will really avoid saying something that's to those words of like, "Oh, we're really counting on this next generation," because that's too much pressure and it's not fair to say that and to put that out there. So we all can be learners for nature and be advocates for nature. And frankly, we all should be that and be part of it, especially if we want to be solutionaries and action oriented and embody the hope and optimism that helps makes us healthy and vibrant. So hope that was useful and valuable. Thank you for letting me share with you both. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much, David. And what a terrific note to end on. I mean, hope is such a tricky thing. It can be weaponized as part of propaganda, but when it comes from a good faith place, we absolutely need it. And there's always something to strive for. There are still, amid the gloom, there are reasons for hope. And I heard somebody say recently, hope dies last.
Hmm.
Seems pretty true.
That's it. Part of my favorite thing to do when I go into school districts, which tends to slightly perturb sometimes the administrators until they get to know me, is to dress up in some sort of various way to inspire some sort of connection. And like, the teenagers are like, "Oh my goodness, what are you doing?" But actually, I say that most of them really embrace it because silliness and weirdness, I think, creates. I put myself in a vulnerable space to say, hey, you too can look a bit funny and sound a bit funny and still have an important thing to say. But I'm now planning already my solutionary outfit, which will involve a cape. And any excuse for a cape, I'm telling you, I'm already plotting out the image. Unless you have one already, but the solutionary, it's almost like the Superman-esque. Yeah. And I can definitely see that because I'm doing a lot of work with young people on climate. One of my young change makers, her name's Maya Carr, and she works with the Canadian Rockies Youth Network, where they've built this phenomenal nonprofit that's run by young people. Yeah. And she said, I'm sick of people also saying to me, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
And she says, how about ask me, what are you doing now?
Yeah.
Because I'm forming organizations. I'm putting my voice out there. I'm paying time and energy and effort into caring. And so it's when those two meet together that the people perhaps who have a bit more social agency, who have a greater voice, meet with those to stand together as solutionaries in action. That's when really powerful things happen. And it's been really wonderful to meet you. I have generally come out of these new relationships or conversations with people in this work with this sense of joy and optimism. And today it feels quite expansive, you know, it's sort of like a balloon that's just really pushing against the walls.
Yeah. I can't wait to see your outfit either. And so, you know, I can imagine it's a good cape and it's going to involve some awesome, in my mind, is red boots. Is it's going to be some high, tall, really cool boots too, Jade? So,
you got it. And maybe some sort of eye mask. We make recycled t-shirts into like shopping bags, and then my kids turn themselves into eco superheroes and made hero masks. So there's a mask as well for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll plan it out. I'm not a very good artist, I should say. I participate in art, therefore I'm an artist, but it takes me a little time to go from conception to delivery, but you're getting a picture first thing, and it has to go over snow pants for the winter. So a few things to check off. David, it's been a fantastic pleasure to have you here on the Earthy Chats podcast. Any closing words you want to share with us, a website or anything you just want people to go to for their next steps?
Well, you know, you certainly can go to the Green Schools National Network .org website and check out some of the work that we're doing. And within that, look for the green print that also outlines some of those things I was talking about. But and then just feel free to connect with me if ever you want to chat more. I love talking about these things, and I love people like you all that are advocates and pushing forward in this work. And it takes all of us, you know, to be on the front lines and be there together with arms together, supporting both young people and us older people too, you know, like everybody needs that support and that work going forward. So just thank you for the opportunity, and I appreciate you both, and I look forward to future conversations.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for joining us for this month's Earthy Chat. You can find the resources featured in this podcast at the Outdoor Learning Store. That's www.outdoorlearningstore.ca. You can also visit greenteacher.com for incredible educational resources and webinars. And CBEEN, that's CBEEN.org, for a range of environmental resources, including professional development opportunities, grant information, and green jobs. Lastly, you can visit www.stokedonscience.com to chat with me, Jade, about science workshops or educational consulting. Tune in next month for more cross-pollination of ideas and another fun, earthy chat.
Well, we have some good stuff for the blooper reel. This is good. Yeah. And it's natural. It's organic. So, hey, no worries.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. I'm so sorry about that. No, I've never good. had that experience where my computer said that it ran out of application memory.
Oh,
and
ooh.
so
sounds
I don't know what that
ominous.
means, but